Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Did you know that tobacco is native only to the Americas? That Adolf Hitler opposed smoking while Franklin Roosevelt declared cigarettes essential to the American war effort? But today it may be labeled the biggest killer in history. This week we look into the curious history of tobacco with our guest, Ian Gately. And after that, David Elwood joins us to talk about the myths surrounding the Marshall Plan and the rebuilding of Western Europe following World War II. We begin with Dan Roberts and the second in his three-part A Moment in Time series on the eruption of Mount Vesuvius.
The eruption in AD 79 of Mount Vesuvius, which towers over Italy's Bay of Naples, was one of the most destructive events to take place in the ancient world.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
Early in the afternoon of August 24th at Misenum, the sister of the eminent naturalist and Roman imperial bureaucrat Gaius Plinius Secundus, commander of the fleet at Naples, called her brother from his study to see an unusual cloud formation rising east across the bay in the vicinity of Mount Vesuvius. It was shaped like a pine tree, and both trunk and crown were punctuated with bright, glowing flashes. Ever the scientist, the elder Pliny ordered up a swift, light vessel so as to investigate this phenomenon. But before he embarked, a note arrived from Rectina, wife of Bassus, a family friend, whose villa at the base of the volcano was in imminent danger of destruction. Alarmed, Pliny ordered the entire fleet into the bay on a mission of rescue. It was a mission well needed. For centuries, the great Vesuvius lay dormant, but in that single afternoon, the sleeping giant awoke and, with volcanic ash and fire, destroyed hundreds of farms and villages and buried the three small cities of Stabiae, Herculaneum, and Pompeii. Pliny went ashore to examine the destruction and reassure the terrified population, but late that evening he was caught among the crowds fleeing to the seashore and succumbed to noxious fumes. Those who were not buried the first day were overcome the next morning by nuée ardente, fast-moving surges of pyroclastic material and heated gas. Slowly these towns were buried, but were also protected from vandalism, looting, climate, and weather. Next time, Resurrection at the University of Richmond. This is Dan Roberts.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, BBC News reports that evidence from a newly discovered archive support a long-standing but thus far unsubstantiated claim that a German scientist invented the telephone 15 years before Alexander Graham Bell. Information gathered from archives found in the London Science Museum points to research scientist Philip Reese as having created a device that could transmit and receive speech in 1863 and explains that the successful tests of the device were covered up. The person behind the cover-up appears to have been Sir Frank Gill, chairman of Standard Telephones and Cables, the company that conducted the tests. STC was in the process of bidding for a contract from Bell's American Telephone and Telegraph Company. This is Talking History. Since it was first made known to the world, soon after its discovery in America, tobacco has brought pleasure and pain to people around the globe. Our guest this week, Ian Gately, describes it as an exotic plant that seduced civilization. Gately discusses the history of tobacco with Talking History's Fred Nielsen.
Tobacco is native only to the Americas, which is where humans first found it. In the thousands of years since, tobacco use has spread around the globe, ignoring the boundaries of nation-states, race, class, and sex. In the process, it has brought pleasure, stimulated intellectual inquiry, driven the growth of the American colonies, and enriched its manufacturers, and even, to a lesser extent, its opponents. It has also killed millions. There is no other plant quite like it. With me to discuss tobacco's equivocal place in human history is Ian Gately, the author of Tobacco, A Cultural History of How an Exotic Plant Seduced Civilization. Mr. Gately, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Who were the first humans to use tobacco, and what did they use it for?
Well, the first humans were in South America, and it was probably about 6,000 years ago. And it spread from there right through the Americas, so that by the time Europeans came into contact with what they called the New World, it was pretty much ubiquitous. It was used for an immense variety of purposes, and it was also used in a great variety of ways. One could start, say, in South America, where it was used as a medicine. It was used as an insecticide, and it was used as in religious worship. And finally, it was also used for pleasure. And from these, by a sort of sympathetic magic, the reasons for its use multiplied. Because let's take the insecticide as an example, that they used to blow tobacco smoke over seed corn before planting. And it's actually quite an effective insecticide in that role. It was used as such right up until the 1950s. But in these native cultures, by extension, if it improved the fertility of the crops, it might also improve the fertility of people. So they used to blow smoke over couples who had just been married on their wedding night in the belief that it would make them more fertile as it had done the crops.
Europeans then are introduced to tobacco when they get to the New World. What do they think they're seeing? What do they make of this new crop that has so many different uses?
Well, there was, one might say, a mixture of excitement and consternation. I mean, the first Europeans to come across it were if we discount the possibility of Viking smoking sometime in the 11th century, with Christopher Columbus, and in October 1492, when he reached Cuba, he sent a couple of men ashore on the lookout for Chinese because he believed he'd reached China. And they literally came, on the first meeting, they came across people smoking what appears to have been a giant cigar, as the size of cigars which people smoked for ritual purposes were really, really quite large. I mean, this was said to be as thick as a forearm. And a couple of his crewmen had a puff. But
ask if a cigar that large is still a cigar.
Yeah, well, I mean, some of the ritual ones used in South America are up to 9 feet long, and they're propped up on special cigar stands like tuning forks. But those were used for shamans by divination. If a casual smoker were to take one, they would be in probably quite serious trouble. But the Spanish didn't really pay very much attention to smoking. I mean, in part because their conquests were to the south. And also, and perhaps more importantly, was that instead of being initially curious as to the customs of the races that they'd conquered, they held them in disdain. So that smoking was seen really to be just another part of the devil worship which they perceived these cultures to follow. And so one could summarize then that the sort of initial reaction was probably bad, and it was bad on religious grounds. When the French, and latterly the English, came up to the coast of North America, their reaction was very different. I mean, often they'd come hadn't come so much as conquerors, but they were rather there to try and raid the Spaniards. So they were a little more curious in the customs of the cultures who they came across. And also they had to treat, as opposed to, that they weren't there in the strength of numbers of the Spaniards, so that it was in their interest to cooperate with the cultures they came across. And they were very much more positively disposed towards smoking. I mean, to them, let's say that they had the leisure of its purposes being explained to them. So they took it up, at least on the sort of explorers, adventurers side, as a shield against hunger, so that they saw the Indians smoking to ward off hunger when they were on the march, and they used it for the same purposes. And it's only when it got back to Europe that attitudes really began to change.
Well, tobacco becomes absolutely central to the English colonies in the southern part of what would become the United States, Virginia and other southern colonies. Raising it was terribly hard work, for which they soon acquired slaves.
That's quite right. I mean, when the English went out to found their colonies, and again, it was on a very different model to the Spaniards. I mean, it was their aim wasn't subjection and establishment of an empire, at least not initially. It was to set up farms where they could grow things which there was demand for at home, but they couldn't actually produce in the UK. So the colonies were founded to grow, let's say, olive oil and wine and even silk, and obviously to mine for gold too. But they kept failing. I mean, all of those crops have a certain lead time. And during the same period, there'd been a sudden growth in demand for tobacco in England. It had become fashionable. All the smart young men smoked it. There were poems written about it. There were plays in which smokers appeared, sort of performing slightly theatrical gestures with their pipes and blowing huge smoke rings. So there was a very real demand for it, and it could be grown very quickly, so you could have a crop in a year. And in essence, it was the salvation of the colonies in Virginia at first, because here was a product which they could make, that they used the assistance of the indigenous tribes too to grow, and that there was a ready market for it over the seas. The thing with tobacco growing, of course, is that it's extremely labor intensive. I mean, if one looks at, say, the current production of tobacco in Cuba, where it's more or less done in a traditional way, that each plant will be visited 100 times in the course of its growth and it being picked. So in that sense, you know, the shortage of labor in the New World was always acute. And as soon as the English had a crop to grow, they needed as many hands as they could. And when a Dutch ship passed by with slaves for sale, which they'd actually hoped to sell to the Spanish, the English colonies took them at once. So tobacco, in that way, was responsible for the introduction of slavery to the United States.
There are, by the 19th century, good ways and bad ways to use tobacco. Charles Dickens comes over to the United States in the 1840s and thinks that the majority of Americans are using tobacco in the wrong way. They chew it and spit it instead of lighting it up, and he hates this with a fervor akin to his hatred of slavery.
That's quite right. I mean, it's interesting how tobacco use in the two continents diverged. I mean, in Europe, for instance, after tobacco was introduced, for a century or more, it was, and this is outside Britain, it was used as snuff. So people used to sniff it as opposed to smoke it. And the chewing it had never really spread to Europe as a fashion. Whereas in the United States, which were intensely rural, people had taken up chewing it as the standard mode of use. I mean, that may have come about because of, in the early English colonies in the United States, smoking was banned by the church. I mean, it was considered to be ungodly, so that the only way people could take their tobacco was by chewing it. So what happened when Dickens came over? I mean, he was very keen. He had a big readership in the States. He was a Republican at heart, so it was felt that it would be a meeting of minds. You know, the great English Republican comes over to the greatest republic in the world. But he seems to have... He fell out of his bunk into a pool of tobacco spit on a riverboat, and that seems to have tainted him against it indelibly, to the extent that in his American travel notes, he seems to be obsessed with tobacco spitting. Though, in curiously, it wasn't limited to him alone. The Fanny Trollope, the mother of Anthony Trollope, the great author, also wrote a comment on American customs and manners, and she was very keen to highlight differences, and tobacco was one of the great differences.
When and where did cigarettes first appear?
They are probably a Spanish invention, in that the Spaniards were great smokers and snuff takers, and all of their production was subject to a monopoly, which ran through Seville. Now, for the poorer people who couldn't afford cigars, they would literally pick up scraps of tobacco and wrap them in paper, and that's the birth of the cigarette. But they were carried from there into France. After the Napoleonic Wars, the French became fascinated by the beauties of Andalusia, and in particular by its seemingly carefree women who smoked cigarettes. And so French writers began to smoke, perhaps in order to seduce the cigareras. And they began to talk about cigarettes in their work. So they gradually spread through Europe. I mean, at first they were frowned on. They were thought to be effeminate. They were thought to be... So many rituals had grown around smoking that, you know, it was considered to be very much a leisure activity. A man would sit down with his pipe. He would prepare it carefully. He would have a tobacco jar. He would have a smoking jacket, a smoking cap, and would sit around with his friends smoking. I mean, it was considered to be a sort of full-time leisure activity, almost like going for a game of golf. Whereas a cigarette could be enjoyed anywhere, and it was over very quickly. So as a consequence, it came in for quite a degree of criticism, and not just, say, in England, but especially, too, in America.
You write that by the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the answer to the question, at least in America, to the question, why do you smoke, was Buck Duke. Who was he?
Well, Buck Duke was the younger son of a tobacco producer in the South, who was responsible for automation of the cigarette industry. I mean, cigarette growth cigarette use spread gradually in the latter half of the 19th century. But even though there were quite a lot of people buying cigarettes, they were still all made by hand. And Duke had the idea of introducing a cigarette machine, which in the 1880s he finally managed to do. Now, this brought with it all the benefits of automation in that it meant that very many more cigarettes could be produced and also that they could be done at a much cheaper price. He was also a fan of advertising. I mean, he introduced cigarette cards into the packaging of his cigarettes, which had pictures of actresses or baseball stars, latterly. So it's a two-pronged thing. He automated production, thereby making cigarettes more available and cheaper, and he marketed his production so that he had a variety of brands and that most people, when they came across a cigarette for the first time, would do so really courtesy of Buck Duke.
I'm curious what, if anything at all, we should conclude from the fact that Hitler was vehemently opposed to smoking while Franklin Roosevelt declared cigarettes essential to the American war effort in World War II.
Well, I mean, Hitler's opposition was perhaps, I'm no psychologist, but, you know, his desire to have absolute control over everything and the idea that people might be smoking and damaging themselves seemed to him to be unacceptable, whereas Roosevelt was a realist, saw that his soldiers smoked, and it seemed to have been a lesson of the First War, so ensured that they were always had a constant supply. I mean, there has been some unfortunate side effects from, let's say, the polarization of the Nazi opposition to tobacco and the American, it being held in favor by Americans, and that Nazi scientists were the first to discover a link between smoking and lung cancer, but the research was tainted by the people who produced it. So one might say that it set back the cause of showing that smoking is actually dangerous by a good 10 years.
Is the cigarette, as some have claimed, the biggest killer in history?
Well, if one looks at the statistics, there's certainly a good claim. I mean, the figures for the United Kingdom, for instance, that cigarettes kill or contribute to the deaths of 120,000 people a year. Now, that's more per annum than were killed in the Second World War. So it's certainly a giant killer. I mean, that the World Health Organization considers it to be an epidemic, and an epidemic far more deadly than AIDS or, you know, any of the other current diseases.
We only have about a minute remaining. You conclude that tobacco is the most equivocal substance in daily use. I wonder if you could elaborate on that.
Well, it's difficult to imagine if a product such as a cigarette was invented today and had to pass through health and safety legislation that it would be legal at all, so that its survival really relies on custom. But it also relies on profit. In the sense that the production and sale of cigarettes is incredibly profitable, but smoking has been related to taxation almost since it appeared outside of the traditional cultures of the Americas. And it's a balance between the danger it causes and the profit it makes for governments and other people involved in the industry. So I think that's what makes it particularly equivocal. It's extremely dangerous, but it's extremely profitable. And governments seem to have taken the view that the profit outweighs the danger.
Well, Mr. Gately, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you very much indeed for your time.
I've been visiting with Ian Gately, the author of Tobacco, A Cultural History of How an Exotic Plant Seduced Civilization.
The European Recovery Program, better known as the Marshall Plan, began as an effort to rebuild Europe after World War II. It became a weapon in the Cold War and the source of many myths, some of which our guest commentator this week, David Elwood, seeks to correct. Elwood is a professor of international history at the University of Bologna.
A new official exhibition opens in Paris. The Berlin Film Festival features its big movie output. A great musician, Daniel Barenboim, calls it the last example of a self-interested as well as generous and far-sighted U.S. foreign policy. The myth of the Marshall Plan is alive and well in Europe in 2004. In the wilder world, every nation in trouble or just coming out of it is thought fit for the Marshall Plan treatment. South Africa, Russia, ex-Yugoslavia, Palestine. So what historical reality lies behind these dreams? At a 50th anniversary conference, Marshall Plan veteran Harlan Cleveland stated bluntly, "It was not, of course, a plan. It was a continuous international happening with frequent course corrections. It was a brilliant series of improvisations on a deceptively simple theme. Europe needed help, and only America could supply it." Whatever the original State Department intentions, the European Recovery Programme, its official name, was obviously a weapon in the Cold War. It would never have passed a deeply suspicious Congress without this thrust. But the project had more far-sighted purposes, the ones that led it to become famous as a model in the first efforts to transform the underdeveloped world. In part, they derived from the old New Deal readings of the causes of two world wars and the Great Depression: class hate, poverty, backwardness, and a lack of prospects for change. To raise living standards everywhere was a key aspiration of the people in Washington who sought to rebuild the world after the war. People with prosperity, or at least the prospect of it, didn't turn to totalitarianism. But there was a special European dimension to the Marshall effort which came from the same roots. Europe's evil genie, said people like Acheson, Kennan and Cleveland, was nationalism. If that root of Nazi fascism and all the rivalries of the 1930s could be bottled up in an integrated economic framework, uniting all the old world, then prosperity might stand a chance, and Europe's urge to start world wars and drag America into them might finally be killed off. Modernization and integration then became the watchwords of the ERP, and the arguments turned around how to bring them about. It was central to the method of the plan that the Europeans should think and act for themselves within the vision. That was what made the plan not just another aid program. In the end, every participating nation had its own Marshall Plan experience and made its own bargain with the ERP's prescriptions. Everyone came to recognize that economic modernization was unavoidable and that continent-wide integration was right at the top of that agenda. But through its vast information program, the ERP aimed to get as close as possible to the people it was benefiting at all levels of society. The point was to channel attitudes, mentalities and expectations in directions the Americans understood as progress, an ever-swelling prosperity for an ever-expanding majority. The facts of Europe's economic miracle seemed to confirm that the promises had been kept. In reality, it was the Marshall Plan's psychological blood transfusion, a supreme expression of faith and confidence in the future, that made the difference. And that's the ingredient which seems so much harder to conjure up today.
You've been listening to David Elwood, professor of international history at the University of Bologna and professorial lecturer in European-American relations at Johns Hopkins University SAIS Bologna Center. He's the author of Rebuilding Europe, Western Europe, America in Post-War Reconstruction, published by Longmans Press. And finally, we continue with our reading of another passage from the private unpublished diary of J.C. Wilmarth, Union soldier from Massachusetts. In the last passage, Wilmarth was captured and placed in a Confederate prison near Petersburg, Virginia. May 9, 1864. I forgot to state in my diary of the 16th the process of searching prisoners of war. Upon their arrival to the prison, they are made to stand in two ranks, and the rebel officials proceed to take anything the soldier happens to possess, providing it's good for anything. Anything in the shape of money, knives, good boots, overcoats and blankets, knapsack, canteen, and haversack were sure to be lost by Uncle Sam's soldier. May 22nd, Sunday. The church opposite our prison is chiming its Sabbath bells, and it makes me think of my own dear home. I think I never have felt quite so downhearted as I do today. It makes me almost crazy, and at times I almost say, I would that the war would cease. I care not how, but such feelings do not always last. They pass, and will at times return again. But as we become hardened to the scenes around us, we fight for the time that we have friends at home that are praying for our safe and speedy return to those happy homes we left nearly 2 years ago. We live day after day, hoping we'll see those dear friends and homes, but for that blessed word hope to sustain us our days in this place would be short indeed. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. For more information, visit amomentintime.com. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.
History is a production of the Organization of American Historians.